Endless Hustle is presented by Eat Clean Bro, a convenient solution to bring you the highest quality chef-prepared meals delivered right to your door. Eat Clean Bro is the contract-free solution for your meal prep needs. Made with all-natural ingredients and next-day delivery, every meal feels like you have someone cooking for you right at home.
I fought a good fight. I finished my football race. And after 18 years, it's time.
Basketball players, we're really supposed to shut up and dribble, but I'm glad we do a little bit more than that.
Eventually, every ball would go flat, but that doesn't mean that your life will flatline. What will you do when the game is over?
Good Tuesday, Endless Hustlers. Instead of good morning or good afternoon, it's just good Tuesday. It is a good Tuesday because we've got a great episode of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. As always, I'm your host, Arthur Cade, and we've got two great guests on this episode. We've got a guy who is an actor of the moment, Luke Kirby. He's got a new movie called No Man of God. He's actually playing Ted Bundy. And by the way, guys, I'm not just saying this to say this. Luke is unbelievable as Ted Bundy. His co-star is Elijah Wood in the movie. He plays this FBI profiler who talked to Ted before Ted was executed. The movie is excellent. Can't recommend it enough, but here's why he's one of the dudes of the moment right now. He's also on Gossip Girl. He's obviously an Emmy winner for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Luke Kirby, even though he's had a fantastic career, is having a moment, and we have him on the show. And then our next guest is a very popular reality star, but more importantly, one of the best realtors in America. It's Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles star Tracy Tudor, back with a brand new season of Million Dollar Listing LA on Bravo. It's every Thursday. Let me get the plug in there. Tracy was awesome. I always love talking to people who have real professions and are successful outside of a TV show. Tracy's built an incredible business for herself. She's one of the most successful realtors in California. And I love digging into what it is she does for a living. You guys are going to love this interview. Let's kick it off. Here he is first, Luke Kirby. All right, we've got a great day on The Endless Hustle as I'm joined by Marvelous Mrs. Maisel star and now Ted Bundy star, because he's got this great new movie called No Man of God, Luke Kirby. Luke, I want to start with playing Ted Bundy. First of all, and this is the highest compliment you can give an actor, you embody Ted Bundy, this horrendous human being, his creepiness, his calm, his psychological terror. You did one of the best jobs I've ever seen, if not the best job with him. So I want to give you that compliment. How the heck do you nail this guy's creepiness? I mean, are you watching tons of tape? How do you capture this thing?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot about it that's creepy. You know, the story manifests a kind of, a human ugliness, let's say, and a confounding degree of both violence and denial. And those two things kind of put together it's an astonishing character study of a man just refusing to fess up, you know, and that reverberated with me in the story because it felt kind of, I don't know, I sort of feel like that's a big thing in the public conversation, in the world, you know, just seeing men in high seats of power or any seat of power anywhere, just what it is to not want to, just to sort of not want to fess up, what that means and how people are really kind of, how people will just sort of go to the end of the world to deny their participation in our shared ugliness.
The craziest shit about Ted Bundy is when you look at the guy, good looking guy, smart guy, actually fairly well liked by the people around him, quiet. That's how all these serial killers are. I watch all this stuff on Netflix, and I'm like, man, these serial killers are like the most normal, retreated people.
Yeah.
As an actor, when you start kind of trying to catch that calmness. Is there ever like a want to overact? Because you would almost think these people would be out of their fucking mind, but yet they are so calm. Are there ever moments where you're playing someone like Bundy where you do kind of want to jump out of your own skin and be over the top?
Yeah, and I think that if you sort of search the, you know, editing room floor, there's probably a lot of that. You know, I think that Amber's genius was that she kind of was allowed us to sort of really play in a vein that we didn't feel like everything had to be, we weren't like locking into a tone or a mood of a film. We were sort of in this one room, ostensibly, and we're given a lot of free rein to just play around. And she was able to just sort of, she would throw just very, you know, many different directions our way. And so, yeah, I'm guessing that there's, that impulse is probably true. And thankfully our darling director and editor we're able to keep it away from the public eye.
You get to obviously play one of the great comics and comic minds of all time, Lenny Bruce on Maisel. You've actually kind of become this kind of heartthrob because Maisel's such a beloved show. Every female I know in my circle watches Maisel. And then I get questions, who do you have on the show this week? And I'd mentioned a couple times this week, and I have Lou Kirby. And like, oh my God, I'm in love with him on Maisel. So getting this kind of heartthrob status playing Lenny Bruce, are you getting that on the streets when you're in New York or LA? Are people just like, I love you, Luke?
I mean, it's rare and rarer as the, you know, the more masks I wear, you know, the less that happens. But yeah, it's a delight that, you know, that feature. I'm glad that, you know, if it were to happen, if anybody was deserving of that status, it's Lenny Bruce in my mind. So, you know, happy to give him those props.
Is it harder to play someone who existed like a Ted Bundy or a Lenny Bruce, where we can look up footage, we can really see, is Luke kind of nailing this or not nailing this, or to take a fictional character and put Luke Kirby into that and create whatever you want to create? What's kind of the challenges or the advantages of either side?
I mean, I think the obvious advantage with, you know, real life people is that, you know, if they were, you know, had any kind of accolade and were alive anywhere past, you know, 1930, there's, or 40, there's, you know, footage of them of some kind. And so you can kind of, you know, endeavor to look at them from a physical, you know, like you can look at their physicality, you can hear their voice, and that can only benefit you. I mean, the only thing is that you can get trapped into the, you know, into the, an act of mimicry, you know, which can really be a good in, I think, but you have to sort of then bring some substance under that mimicry. You know, you want to be a parrot who's got his own pulse. So, but I think that it's really, to me, it's you know, certainly with Lenny, it's really fun to have all of this access to his comedy and, you know, a few of the, you know, movies and interviews that he did, and one performance, that one stand-up performance that's on film, you know, all of that stuff is very, very usable. All of it's daunting. I mean, there's no, you know, you're doomed from the beginning. So you just might as well put the other foot in and go for it. It's my feeling.
The failures of an actor, right? The challenges, yes. The failures of an actor. That's I was right. Doing research for our interview, and an article from a few weeks came up with New York Magazine in The Cut. And you've officially reached, according to them, DILF status. Did you see this article yet? Because you're in Gossip Girl.
Yes. Yeah, the word is out. I didn't have to look that one up. But I did have to sort of put it together when I first heard it. But yeah.
So when you see that they called you a DILF, are you like, what the heck is a DILF? What did I fucking get involved in here?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. What can you do? You know, the public will decide our fate, whether we like it or not.
Is it cool when you kind of look at this moment you're going through? Obviously, Maisel, huge hit. Gossip Girl's been a huge hit for HBO Max. You've got this movie. As an actor, when you have these stream of projects happening all at the same time, it's got to be such a rewarding feeling. You don't strike me as the type of guy who kind of sits there and chases fame or anything like that. But is there this kind of rewarding moment where you're looking around and you're like, I'm really on these fantastic projects that are touching a ton of people?
Yeah, yes. It's a great, you know, part of the whole reason for doing this is, you know, it has the kind of look at me factor. And so to feel like you're being watched in this arena, for sure has its bolsters me to kind of want to do more. It's all part of that working life. I don't take that for granted at all. It feels good.
As a young kid in Canada, when do you decide you're going to become an actor? And then getting from Canada to obviously LA and breaking into Hollywood, what was that trek like?
In many ways just felt very lucky. I mean, at the beginning it felt impossible because at that era, you know, it felt so far away. You know, the idea of going and doing a movie, it felt just like an impossibility. But at some point in my early endeavors, that dream went away, and it became more about just doing the work of the actor. I was able to find great teachers back home and make sort of decisions that were based more about how hard the life was going to be and really lock into that side of it and continue to kind of approach it from that angle, and just sort of wasn't so much concerned with the accolade that we just spoke of. And it became kind of a long learning experience, as opposed to a big endless hustle. I mean, the hustle's certainly a part of it, but yeah, the long and winding road is the middle to short answer.
At what point do you realize you may have a career in this business? Like, is there a moment where you're kind of like, all right, I may stick around here for a little while?
I don't know. You have to tell me if that's, you know, if I can. You have to give me the go ahead. I mean, it's work, you know, you have to work. And so you just kind of keep going out there and plugging away. I mean, there are little hints along the way, little things that say, yes. I mean, the best thing that I've had are people who have come before me who have kind of encouraged me to keep going. You know, that's been the kind of the biggest inspiration. You know, anybody who says, oh no, you can do what maybe seemed impossible once, you know, that strikes a chord.
There was a fabulous article that just came out. Jonah Hill is on the cover of GQ. Uh-huh. And it's an incredible interview. Adam McKay, who's directing him in a new movie with Leo and a couple others, is interviewing him, and they're friends. But Jonah talks about how there's this myth for artists that the more tortured and the darker you are, the better your art is. And he actually dispels that. He says, actually, I'm chasing happiness, and the happier I am, the better my art is. As an artist yourself, what are your thoughts? Is it better to have a darkness and to be able to keep something inside, whether it's pain or torture or just whatever? Or do you feel like happiness drives better art?
I don't know. I do think that life, you know, presents a lot of surprises, and many of them are joyous and many of them are painful. And the great thing about, you know, and this kind of work or other kinds of art is that they allow you to be a kind of messenger of something that is within you, and to be able to kind of get in touch with that frequency and be able to, you know, if you can find a path within yourself to kind of get it out, any way of doing that is great. So I don't think one should endeavor to be tortured. You know, one, it's not a, you can't put on a facsimile of tortured, but I also don't think that if, you know, if you have pain that needs to be dealt with, you can't, you shouldn't deny it if it's, if it comes out in any, in a creative way. But I think, you know, part of being here, you know, there is this kind of thing that is called happiness, and, you know, it moves around in a funny way, but we're all kind of searching for it. I think that, I think it's a good thing to seek out occasionally. Yeah, you know, that's the best way to do that, I think, is to stay hydrated.
I love that. So one of the main reasons I started this show, Luke, was to talk to successful people across all genres about the habits, the mentality that helped them create their success. My question for you is, what are some of the habits that you incorporate in your own life in order to continue to elevate both on and off screen?
I think, you know, staying curious and keeping cynicism at bay are sort of two really good, you know, good features, good practices. And, you know, because of the laws of physics and gravity, you know, with age, you can, you know, it becomes harder and harder to keep that cynicism at bay because you're literally kind of calcifying as the years go on. And so you have to also, you know, do whatever, you know, whatever you can, I think, physically to kind of keep feeling a little bit limber. So, you know, the sort of, you know, standard exercise, stretching, and like I said, stay hydrated. You know, these are all good practices. And then there's the, you know, then there's the sort of, you know, you got to look both ways when you cross the street. And, you know, if you can afford to put a little smile on, that can help, I think, you know. But really, in terms of like, in terms of work and profession stuff, I ascribe to the, you know, just work mentality, because I just find without it, one gets very adrift. You know, you just have to work and work and work and see what happens, and then kind of glance at what happens and watch it pass away again and keep working. You know, definitely take pleasure in it for sure, but you know, it's an ongoing thing.
That it is. And remember, stay hydrated, right? No matter what.
By all means, please.
Luke, this was awesome. Congratulations on No Man of God. Of course, Maisel coming back. And Gossip Girl, you're a busy guy, fantastic actor. And I think, like I said, people are going to really enjoy seeing No Man of God, because you did such a fantastic job embodying this horrendous human being, but also humanizing him, because it's hard to really understand why a person could do what this man did. But ultimately, there's something going on inside of him that did drive him to these heinous crimes. And I thought you really did a great job embodying what he was thinking and feeling and understanding internally. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's incumbent upon us to sort of always be aware of what's going on within ourselves. And you know, we shouldn't deny the our sort of uglier features. You know, we have to figure, we've got to figure that out. And listening to it is and communicating about it is important. I thank you for all that.
No, thank you, Luke. Congratulations, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, man. Have a good one.
You too. Take care, man. All right, folks, that was, of course, Luke Kirby. Make sure to check out his brand new movie, No Man of God. It is excellent. And I'm a sucker. God, this sounds horrible when I say it, but I'm a sucker for anything Ted Bundy. But I'm not the only one. There's been such a fascination with serial killers and true crime recently. So although they're bad, bad people, it is entertaining to watch. And Luke does an unbelievable job as Ted. Honestly, probably the defining Ted Bundy in my mind. And a great actor in general. Our next guest, Million Dollar Listing LA star Tracy Tudor. I had interviewed her a long time ago when she first joined the show, and I didn't remember what to expect. I fucking loved this interview because it was less about the show, which obviously they've got a show to promote, but just digging into her career. Real estate is booming right now. And I love talking to someone who's doing multi-million dollar deals, working with celebrities, working with athletes about the good and the bad and the ugly of what they do. And as someone who's been in sales his whole life, I love hearing from other salespeople about the mentality that it takes in order to be successful. So love Tracy. Of course, Million Dollar Listing LA is a huge hit for Bravo. I think you guys are going to really dig this interview. So here she is, Tracy Tudor. All right, we've got a real estate filled day on The Endless Hustle as I'm joined by one of the best in the business and star of Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles, Tracy Tudor. Congratulations, another season of this behemoth of a show. How exciting is it to be back?
So exciting. Thank you so much for having me. I mean, my fourth year, the show's 13th season. I mean, we're one of the longest running shows on Bravo. It's awesome. I can't believe like Thursday's here. It's been a long year, but we got there.
All right. So you were a successful realtor before you joined the show, but then you join a Bravo show. You become a Bravo celebrity. How does it change? Is it a good thing, a bad thing? Does it not change? What happens after that for your business?
I'm obsessed with our fans just as much as they're obsessed with the show. I mean, we've got the greatest fans in the world. A, they love watching the real estate and they love it as much as we do. And B, I do think that they connect with us on a personal level, but the show is a little bit different. Like, I don't really consider myself a Bravo celebrity. I wish I was, but I don't know if I'm that cool. But, you know, nevertheless, you know, we're lucky to have like such a great following of people who are consistently year after year fans of our show. So that's pretty exciting.
How does it change your business model? Do people now, because you're on TV, want to work with you? Is there a cool factor? Can it be a negative in certain instances? How does it play in terms of your business?
I mean, I think it could go both ways. I work with a lot of high profile clients, but when I signed on to do the show, I was really particular and specific with the clients that I knew would not want to be a part of it, that this was a very separate thing. And I'm very protective of those clients that want to keep their private lives private and not appear on the show. So most of my high profile clients do not participate. And that's perfectly fine with me. I'm having a ton of fun working with new and interesting clients all the time. I've met so many people because of the show. And, you know, so it's been a real blessing. It's kind of opened up my world and the business to people that I haven't met before. And that's the best part about it, because prior to this show, I really worked by referral only via family, friends, and old clients. So all of a sudden, when you get a phone call from a client that's like, hey, I'm a big fan of the show and my husband and I want to sell our house and we just think that you'd be a great fit for us. And it's like, that's just the coolest thing in the world.
So when you take somebody on, and I'm always fascinated because real estate is so freaking hot right now, but I'm 43. I remember the ebbs and the flows, and I was a financial advisor for a decade before moving into entertainment. So I really remember the ebbs and the flows. When you're taking on a client, what is the process for you? Like, how do you approach it? What makes you different? And how is that differentiated from when you started to where you're at now?
Well, 21 years of learning what not to do. No, I think for me, it's it's always connection, and that drives everything that what I do, from any sort of exterior relationships, businesses that I'm invested in. For me, it's all about the person that I'm sitting across from, and whether or not I make a connection with them that's honest and feels good to me. I've learned that the hard way. There are a lot of people and clients that I've worked with that I don't know if I would ever work with again. You know, but by failure and, you know, sort of figuring it out through taking chances and risks and working with someone that I might not be comfortable with, it only sort of got me, I think, to a place where I started to trust my instincts and my gut more. And now it's like, oh, big red flag. That's a no-no. I don't want to work with someone like that. You know, it's just, you know, tried and true. You got to keep like meeting people and sorting out what works for you and what doesn't.
So with the high profile clients, I've had Ryan Serhant on the show recently, and obviously he works with some beasts. I mean, some incredible, incredible people. And he was telling me about some of the demands, some of the personalities. He just sold like a $140 million place in Miami. He's walking me through that story. I'm like, holy shit, this is crazy. What is it when you're working with that type of client? Is it a different mindset? How do you appeal to the crazy stuff they're asking for? Like, what's the game plan going in with someone like that?
You know, there isn't really a game plan. I will tell you, like, I'm in a deal right now where some of my like $45 million deal, maybe my easiest client ever, trust me implicitly, just knows that I'm not going to steer them wrong on the purchase. And so that feels really good. It also feels like an enormous responsibility. So, you know, that's sort of where you have to draw the line and say, hey, I need you. I need, as much as I want to take care of this for you, I need you to be invested. It's too important. It's the biggest asset you're going to own. So there's clients like that, and you get one of them at, like, I like to say it's like my once a year, like, blessing that keeps me in the business, because 8 out of 10 times, like,
they're pains in the ass.
They're a night. Like, I've literally, like, I was, my colleague that posted me on her Instagram the other day, I was like sweating in this. I had sold my friend's house, beautiful home in the Palisades. It was like $25 million, and someone bought it furnished. And when I say furnished, like, they wanted the sheets, the mattresses. Now, that's like common in a, you know, vacation home, right? But in someone's like home of 20 years, like, it's, you know, you don't really want to give that up. And this buyer was a nightmare. And I think so much so that they even understood, their agent understood, like, this is just too much. Cut to, it's time for them to take tenancy. And we had to go in. I had to buy all the kitchenware because my client wanted to take her dishes. And I had to, and I remember the agent saying to me in an email, so when we go in there tomorrow, should we start with washing the dishes? And I wrote back and I was like, way, way out of line. Not only, you tell them, not only am I not washing their dishes, they'll be lucky if I put them in the cabinet. You know what I mean? Because the expectation is so crazy in our business that someone would think that I was going to like wash dishes for them. Like, you gotta be kidding me. But of course, guess who was there? That was me. Baseball caps, sweats, like unloading the Crate and Barrel boxes one by one. It's like, you know, you do what you have to do to get to the finish line, but it's not fun.
Listen, for the commission you're probably making, I'd be scrubbing floors, doing their laundry. I think whatever you guys need.
Right. You say that, but then cut to, they always try to dip into your pocket at the end. Well, you didn't get the glass that I wanted. And you're like, let me guess, you would like a credit, you know? So it's money. It's always exchange. Commissions are always, you know, jumped on. You know, we make a lot of money for what we do, but we also take on an enormous responsibility, and liability. So I feel like we earn every cent we make.
So what was the worst? I mean, washing dishes sounds pretty horrendous, but what was the worst experience you ever had with a buyer or seller?
Ooh, wow. I mean, I've gotten, you know, I mean, as soon as last week, I had a client that said to me on a house on Hollywood Hills house, beautiful house. He did a gorgeous job on the house, hired me to sell it. So what do you think you could sell it for? And I said, you know, he said, maybe 5 million one. And I said, no, I really think this is, if you price it just under five, you have the ability to maybe get a multiple and maybe we sell it for full price. And he said, great. I want you to have the listing. You'll do like your video and your outreach and all of the stuff that you do, Tracy. And I said, yes, you'll be the one to show it. And I said, yes, no assistance. And I said, absolutely not. He said, great. I would like 10% off your commission and I will handle opening the house for you, setting the music, making sure it's clean, that there's waters out, da, 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 da. I go, you know what? I'm going to have to pay an assistant that anyway out of my commission. Fine. You know what? You want that? Great. Came to me after and said, but if you sell the house at ask price, I will give you your full commission. And I said, okay, great. Granted, biggest mistake, I did not put that in writing. I sold the house to the first buyer that walked through the front door at full price, put it in escrow. Then he wanted like a credit, you know, it can't be $1 under ask. And I said, great. Inspections went perfectly. No credit asked for there. Everything went perfectly all the way to the finish line. And then all of a sudden, seller goes silent. We're like, so we just need to make an adjustment to the commission because, you know, we sold it at full price. Silence. Did not hold up to his, you know, the end of his bar. He said, I just don't like the way, you know, your business partner was a little tough on me, you know, during the escrow and you were a little tough. And I said, tough. I sold your house at full price. I did everything you asked me to do. I did a video that cost me money after putting it in escrow at full price. And I closed it in 30 days. What do you want from me? And ultimately we had to end up giving him the commission, but it's like, people are just gross. He was one of those people. I will tell the story over and over because I told myself when he did this to me, how am I going to like feel good about this going forward? I had to give him the money. So I did, but now he's going to be talked about on podcasts all over.
What an asshole. That's amazing.
Total asshole.
It's like when you're dating someone who's an asshole and you just tell everybody that they know or not or don't know and just put the word out. I love it. You're like putting the societal hit on him. Or,
well, and when someone's like, I'm not like every other developer, I'm straightforward, I'm an honest guy. And so I just wrote back, yeah, so much for honest and straightforward. You're a scumbag like the rest of them, you know?
I love it. How'd you get into the business? So talk me through, when does a decision get made that you actually want to get into real estate?
I mean, I was an actor and I'd studied theater at USC. So I was like in the thick of the grind post-college. I was waiting tables and like trying to like do the whole acting thing. And I realized like I didn't really fit the mold of like anything. I wasn't like the beautiful like girlfriend, but I also wasn't quite like the funny character type actor. Like I never fit. I was like worried. And I said, you know, ultimately I want to be financially independent. I don't want to wait tables for the rest of my life and like pretend I'm going to be an actor. And like, maybe one day I make it and someone finally finds me worthwhile. Like, I don't know. It was a really different time when I was, you know, 22, 23 years old and like in the thick of it. And I just made a decision that I don't want to do it anymore. I said, it was more important for me to feel like I had some sort of control over my success. And when you're an actor, you don't. So I got my real estate license and figured this is like one of the few careers where, you know, most failed actors go into real estate. And number two, like I didn't need some sort of degree in business or economics or whatever to have a career, successful career doing it. So that's how I got started.
So when you start, what is it like? Success out of the gates? Or are you like, shit, this sucks. What am I doing with my life?
Oh my God. I remember when I walked into like sit down for my first interview, which I got, they hired me because I was cocky. And you know, the manager of the Sotheby's office, it was actually DBL at the time. It was a boutique firm in the Sunset Strip. And he said, you know, what do you really hope for in your first year in real estate? And I was like, well, I need to make $90,000 a year in order to really survive. And he was like, do you know what most real estate agents make? And I was like, no. How much? And he's like, 30. And I go, no. 30, no way. I make more money waiting tables. Like, you know, 30 is not going to work for me. And he's like, so you're saying you're going to make 90? And I said, I have to. It's just the way it is. And he's like, you're hired. For the next 2 years, I made $30,000 a year.
You swallowed it. You were just like, shit.
I totally did. I ate my words. And, you know, like, I think thinking because I grew up in LA and I knew people and, you know, I could do this. Like, how smart do you really have to be? But the truth is, all the people that I knew were my parents' friends and that actually owned homes, and they weren't going to trust like a 24-year-old or a 23-year-old with like the sale of their house. Like, they were like, yeah, come back to me in 10 years. So I did. I stuck with it.
When do you start breaking through? When do you start seeing a level of success and you're getting down to the 7- and 8-figure homes? What was that big step? When did you experience it?
I want to say in my third year in real estate, I had sort of what I've considered like my first big sale that would equate to like a commission that would equate to like most people's salary. And that's when I was like, holy shit. Like, I just made like $175,000 like in one check. Like, I could do this 6 more times this year. Are you kidding me? Like, that was bananas to me because I never thought in a million years, nor did I ever think about like what I would make as an actor. I was just hoping to be a working actor. So when I got into real estate, I realized, holy God, I could actually make a fortune doing this. And that's when I really, really honed in on it. And by year 5, I, you know, obviously came into my own a little bit more. I had worked on a team for a while, which I really sort of changed everything to me. I think it's something that most people getting into our business think that if they're connected and smart, like, why can't they just start on their own? But it's a whole different world, particularly in California real estate. So many legal issues, so much stuff that you have to be a part of. We don't just like open doors and, you know, send it off to the attorneys. Like, we're there beginning, middle to end. And then of course we wash the dishes. So
when you get the $175,000 commission, what's your mindset? Are you like, oh shit, I'm rich. Do you realize you've got to put like half away for taxes? Do you then go buy yourself an extravagant car? Like, what happens?
No, I was so thrilled because, like, in, you know, as an actor, I got out of school and I was waiting tables and my parents were still helping me. And for me, I was like, now I get to do whatever I want. Like, I don't have to listen to you anymore. And I never wrote like a big check for a while. I'm not like the Altmans, for crying out loud. I don't, you know, I really was just happy to feel like financially independent. And if I wanted to take a vacation with my friends, I didn't have to like ask my dad for money. There was something like that just was really difficult for me. Like, once I was in my 20s, that I just did not want to be beholden to my family anymore. And so it was like, for me, the real prize was the freedom, and that financial independence was everything to me.
Do you take off from there? Do you end up having 6 more deals like that year and never look back? Or was
no,
it?
No, I think, yeah. I mean, listen, I think you're like, I'm in, like, game on. And then you of course realize that, like, oh, for like the one big deal, like there were like 5 fails or whatever. And, you know, and that's, I was talking about this a little bit ago, you know, that's the highs and lows of this business. Even now, 21 years later, I mean, last week was the most stressful week, I'd say, of 2021 for me, as far as like closings and high maintenance clients and making sure I'm delivering and just a lot of money at stake. And so like just the anxiety and the stuff that you go through. And then all of a sudden, like, you're like, do I have a day off? Like, this is bizarre. And that's, you know, it's great. It's also unsettling. Like, there's no rhyme or reason sometimes to, you know, a good week or a bad week in this business. But fortunately this year we've had more good weeks than bad.
So obviously, and listen, I'm not a realtor, but I have a bunch of friends who are. I still follow the markets here and there, but it sounds like real estate is absolutely fucking killing it right now. What happens when it's a down year or a down period? What is that like for a realtor?
It's awful. I mean, only the strong survive. You know, there's a lot of people that get into this business, some of which who watch our show, they're like, it's so awesome and easy. And you could like make your own hours. And you know, what what the real takeaway of our job is that, you know, there are no hours. There are no hours because my clients call me at 10 o'clock at night. My boyfriend's laying in bed with me and he's like, are you kidding me? And I'm like, sorry, it's a big commission, you know, but it's just the nature of the beast. But, you know, in the down markets, like we struggle too. Fortunately for me, I'm in a place in my career where this isn't the only thing that encompasses like what makes me happy or what makes me feel successful in life. So even in a down market, I'm still going to do what I do, but I also embrace that. Like when it does slow down for like the holidays and stuff like that, like I want to spend time with my family. I want to take advantage of those moments that I'm not crazy and working until 10 o'clock and I'm coming home from showings at 9 p.m. I value that time as well. So for me, it doesn't define whether I'm going to make a comeback or not. It's just a dip in the market that I will, you know, obviously survive.
See, I'm the complete opposite. When shit slows down, I'm ready to jump off the roof. I'm like, what do I do with myself? Life is over. Like this month has been like, I'm pulling my hair out. You know, it's just like people aren't returning emails and you're just like, oh my God, can summer be over? And my friends, my business partner, everybody's like, can you shut the fuck up? Everything's fine. Relax.
I have trouble. Just embrace it. Like first of all, I was so pissed off when everybody else was like on vacation all summer. And I was literally coming home from work at 9 p.m. And it was like August. And I'm like, what am I doing? And I was talking to Josh Altman about it. He's like, you know how we have to do it. Like, we don't get to pick and choose when the market's hot. You just have to ride the wave and then go on vacation later. So all of a sudden things slowed down for me this week. And one of my girlfriends was in Italy and like every post is like, it's like an eat, pray, love moment. And you're like, screw you. And she's like pictures of pasta and like an Aperol spritz. And I'm like, God. And sure enough, I booked Italy like yesterday.
Meanwhile, she probably makes 1/10 what you make, by the way.
Whatever. She was living her best life and good for her. I mean, you know, we could all drop dead tomorrow. And if we don't sort of embrace like it's not just about money. It has to be about something more than that. And so for me, it's like, I want to be able to live like life that I want to travel before they shut down again and just really enjoy and embrace like the success that I'm having and appreciate it, like smell the roses.
So who's the Michael Jordan of the game right now? Is it Altman? Is it Oppenheim? Is it Sirhan? Who's at the top of the mountain at the moment?
In my opinion, Drew Fenton. He goes a little bit quiet. He's a little quieter than the rest, but probably one of the most successful, smart, creative and just fierce real estate agents in the market, particularly in Los Angeles. Anyone that's in our business knows exactly who he is, but he rides a really low profile and he has some of the most important clients, you know, and keeps them because he doesn't spread their business all over the press for his own gain.
I was actually going to ask you that because I would think you obviously will see like the leaks in Page Six or any other publication, like, hey, George Clooney's selling his Montecito mansion or whatever, right?
Right.
How does that happen? Is it the realtor leaking? Is it the publicist leaking? What is the process? And is it a good thing for client retention?
You know, it really is. That's like a touchy subject. I know that it was leaked that Josh Flagg was joining our company in the last week. And it was really, really a big disappointment and really unfair to Josh Flagg. I don't know who leaked it. I have no idea. But, you know, it's dangerous territory when you're talking about multimillion-dollar homes and people who signed confidentiality agreements. And then you have a PR asshole that just, you know, needs to get the press out there and just, you know, dumps, and it has zero effect on them, but it does affect the people involved and it can cause like major lawsuits. And it's bad. I'm very discreet when I need to be, and I'm only not discreet when I have the permission of the people that I'm working with to utilize press in an advantageous way. I give zero shits about being recognized for selling the biggest house in, you know, Page Six or whatever. I don't care about any of that. I care about my clients' privacy. And unless they want it out there for the purpose of gaining some sort of attention that serves them, it, you know, people know what I do that need to know what I do. And that's all that really matters.
Yeah, it's so tricky because on one hand, for the realtor, it is a sales game and you want your name out there. But on the other hand, you're right. There's so much confidentiality that happens that you're done. And you probably would get a bad reputation because everybody talks and it's all of a sudden like, hey, Tracy leaked this. And you're just like, fuck, what just happened? So yeah, such a tricky game.
And really 9 times out of 10, it's not the agent because we so directly have to deal with the client. And so when they look at you square in the eye and they're like, this is a confidential sale and I don't want this getting leaked to the press. You know, you need to be careful about, you know, even sharing it on the sideline with a friend because you just don't know who's going to you know, interpret that information and potentially hurt your business.
How does the show happen? Do they come to you? Is it something you sought out? How did it happen for you?
Oh God, Josh Altman was selling a house in the Hollywood Hills that my client came to look at. I guess this was like 5-6 years ago now. And that was on season 9. I saw that re-air. Wow, that was a good look back then. Anyway, they saw us, our chemistry on camera together was kind of funny. And Josh is this huge personality and is like really, really great on the show. But they loved like me giving him a little bit of shit. And so when I actually placed an offer on the property on behalf of my client, they were like, oh my God, we have to film this. Would you like do another scene? And I said, my client won't want to, but I can. So Josh and I did a couple scenes together. And after it aired, I got a call from the producer saying, you know, would you be interested in having a discussion with us about, you know, being on the show?
What are your thoughts at that point? Are you like, this is a horrible idea? It's a great idea. What's going through your head?
You know, I was a little all over the place because obviously reality television had been around forever. And, you know, 10 years prior, I had been approached for a couple of different opportunities and I was never into it because I was like, it will annihilate my career. You know, like, remember when that was happening? Like, everybody was like, ew, reality, gross. Like, that's like a death sentence for anybody in business. And now it's like people do anything to like have the opportunity as an entrepreneur to have a show like what we have. So I was 40. My girls were old enough to, they were away at school. They weren't toddlers anymore. I'd been married for, you know, 13 years at the time or 12 years. And I just went, you know what? I feel good with where I am. I couldn't have done this 10 or 15 years ago, but now I'm sort of unapologetic. And if you like me, great. And if you don't, shit, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll be the villain.
What was the first time you were recognized? And what was your reaction to getting recognized?
Oh, you know what? The first time I was recognized, I was in the airport and I was in security. And a fan after the first season walked up to me in security and just started bawling, crying. And I was like, what is happening right now? And we're like in security together. So we're like going through security and she's crying. And I'm like, don't cry. Like, this is awesome. Let me take a picture and we can talk. Like, so I was really, really flattered and touched by it. But, you know, I've been lucky enough to have a really good, supportive group of people that watch the show who appreciate me being, you know, a female on the show and speaking my mind. And, you know, it's been great. I love the fans of our show.
Do you get a ton of female realtors who now like literally look at you like Jesus at this point? They're like, holy shit, Tracy, you are my God.
I don't know about that, but I think what I've sort of done and been able to do, which is scary even for me, but I think that females in my business understand this on a different level, is sort of be unapologetic about being a female. Like, I will not walk into a room and be nervous about what I want to wear if I'm in a stiletto or a skirt that's too short or I'm wearing a men's suit. Like, whatever it is that I'm doing, I'm unapologetic about it. And I just refuse to be the woman sitting in the boardroom with a bunch of men that, you know, is being pushed into the corner. I'm like a little bit more vocal. And I think I had to be seen on this show. And I remember when I first started the show, everybody was like a little louder. And I'm like, I don't really need to be any louder. Like, trust me, like when I get a little more comfortable, you're going to see enough of that. You don't need to push it out of me. And I think that women gravitated towards that and appreciate it.
Our final segment is courtesy of our show's presenting sponsor, which is Penex, a Villanova Insurance Partners company. And one of the things that I love to do, Tracy, is talk to people about the unique aspects of their career. As a realtor, I think one of the most unique aspects is home staging. So I want to talk to you about, as a realtor, how important is home staging and what are some of the secrets to it?
It is incredibly important. I can't stress it enough. And I will tell you that on the show, at the end of the season, I actually go through something where I convince my clients that it's like a must. It has to happen. And while it was an investment for them that they had no intention of making, you know, I said, please trust me, invest this $50,000, fix it, paint it, and stage it beautifully. And I promise you, the return is going to be in spades. And it worked. And it's worked every time. I've never, ever staged a property and been like, well, that was a mistake. So I do feel like the best thing you can do for a house, particularly if you have a very specific design palette, or you love a tchotchke, is to like sit down with your broker and talk about it and say, look, I want to get top. At the end of the day, like emotions aside, if you want to get top dollar for your house, you should be listening to your broker who wants to get top dollar for your house as well, because they make more money if you make more money. So I believe in it. I think it's super important. And I think 9 times out of 10, whatever the dollar amount you invest in, you will at least get 2.5 times that back.
What is the process when you decide to do the staging? How do you approach it? And then how do you then create what you're supposed to create in order to increase value?
I'm very particular about staging. Like my stagers hate me, I think, a little bit, because I call them and I'm like, what the hell is that? Why'd you leave that chair? Like the scale's off. The lamp is horrible. Get it out. And there's usually like a process with the staging where I say, this is the look that I'm going for. I want it to be a little boho chic. Like this is a writer's retreat. And this is the vibe that I want to feel. And then I come back and I'm like, this says, no, this isn't saying boho chic. This is saying like West Side family. I don't, you know, who is this, you know? And you really have to be able to talk to your clients and say like, this is the buyer pool for your property. And when you're talking about that buyer pool, who are they? What's their profile? Well, that's what the house should speak to. That's what it should look like. And that should be, you know, when you're considering architecture, all of that comes into play, because the people that are ultimately going to walk through the house are going to go, wow, this is a really cool sort of organic, soft, contemporary. Some of the pieces like that are stage or vintage or from the 60s that speak to the time that the house was built. And then it allows you as the broker to be able to tell the story ultimately and hopefully drive the price up.
This was awesome, Tracy. Congratulations. Season 13 of Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. You've got such a great personality. You didn't skip
Thank
a beat.
You.
I love it.
Thanks, Arthur. I appreciate it. It was really fun talking to you guys. You guys tune in on Thursday, 8/7 Central.
Bravo. That's the first time you skipped a beat the whole time, was plugging the show. Smooth sailing till you had to plug the show.
Smooth.
She's like, I can talk about $45 million homes, but when I got to plug the show.
I'm like, wait, what time is it on?
Tracy, you're awesome. Thanks for a fun chat.
Thanks. Talk to you guys
Take
soon.
Care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was Tracy Tudor. Make sure to catch Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles on Bravo every Thursday night. Tracy, thank you for a fabulous interview. And if I'm ever a gajillionaire and buying a $20+ million house in LA, you are the first person I'm calling, because that was such a great interview. All right, folks, that is another episode of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. Show us the love, support, rate, follow us on social media. You can find us on social media. So for Endless Hustle on Twitter, we are at @endless_hustle, at Instagram, at @endlesshustlepod. Me personally, I am at Arthur Cade on Twitter, at It's Me Arthur Cade on Instagram. We are back with an A+ triple header on Thursday. We've got 4 of the best in the business, great actors joining us. We've got Oscar nominee Richard E. Grant, We've got Patton Oswalt and Glenn Howerton, two of my favorite comedic actors on the planet, and stand-ups with Patton. And then we've got Yvonne Orji, who is beginning the final season of Insecure and has a bunch of other projects and is killing it right now. I think you guys are going to love Thursday. So we'll see you then. Have a great day. We'll see you Thursday. Keep endlessly hustling.